Yes, that would be, now would be fantastic. 5, 10 minutes? I tried to mask my relief, my excitement at the prospect of finally being free of the diamonds. They will be out of our home in less than an hour. It will be finished. The bag, the plane, only the USB and the phone nestling under the attic insulation left as evidence. I cradle the phone against my shoulder and hastily jot down the Swiss bank account number on a slip of paper. I've learnt it by heart now. There is no paper trace of the number. I burnt all the paperwork over a week ago, in the garden in our fire pit. All the relevant information is memorized, the number and the password. On his end, I can hear a car engine coming to life.
Right then. 10 minutes it is. See you then.
The line goes dead. He seemed friendly enough. Sounded pretty easygoing. I suppose he must know the situation. My favor, Eddie's favor, our mutual favors. Hell, who am I kidding? Simon's probably been following me all day, hasn't he? From here to Lottie's and back again. I wonder who else has been following me as I go about my day. SO15, Patrick, and now Simon. They can't all be following me. If one of them found out about the others, the whole house of cards would come tumbling down around me. But Simon must have been tailing me today. How else would he know I just got home? That's why he's in the area. I grimace. I might actually be the world's most naive criminal. Completely oblivious. I'm lucky I'm not dead yet. I have less than 10 minutes to prepare before he arrives. I stuff the slip of paper with the account number into my trouser pocket. The stones are up in the attic where I left them after I got them back from Charles. I take the stairs up two at a time. I need to be ready before Simon gets here. I don't want to have to leave him unattended in the house while I go up to the attic alone. I don't want him wandering around. I can't trust him. Suddenly a thought occurs. What if this guy isn't connected with Eddie at all? Or what if he's connected, but somehow I've misread Eddie's personality entirely and this situation isn't going to end well for me? Maybe this isn't safe. I imagine Mark coming home to find my dead body crumpled like a fleshy rag doll in the hallway, a single shot to the head, execution style, job done. But that won't happen, my instincts tell me, and if I can't trust my instincts, what can I trust? I'm sure it's fine. I'm sure. I'm sure I'm sure. Even so, I dash downstairs and grab my phone. I dial Mark's number. 3 rings in, he picks up. He sounds distant, distracted, the background noise muffled. Mark?
Yeah, what's happening? You okay? How'd it go?
He means with Charlotte. Yeah, really good. Listen, quickly. Someone called. Someone called about the... Shit. I suddenly realize I can't say this over the phone, can I? I can't mention the diamonds or Eddie. If Andy's tapped my mobile, then we'll be screwed. Okay, think. Think fast. Talk around it. Someone, wants to collect the honeymoon souvenirs. Is it okay to say that? Sure, it's fine. We bought souvenirs for Mark's folks. If I get them FedEx this afternoon to East Riding, this call is perfectly explainable. God, this is complicated. Being a criminal is mentally exhausting. On the end of the line, Mark is silent. I imagine he's trying to work out what he can and can't say over the phone, too. I'm glad I married someone shrewd.
Okay, that's great. Can you manage by yourself, honey, or should I come back to help?
He keeps his tone even, but I can tell he's worried. He's made his feelings about Eddie clear. He doesn't trust Eddie at all. No, I'm fine. Everything's great, Mark. I just wanted you to know what was happening now. It's all fine. I can manage. I have to dash now, though. He'll be around here in a minute. Okay? I want to give Mark a chance to stop me if I'm being stupid. Am I being stupid? Giving a man I don't know £1 million worth of diamonds. In my own home. Our home.
Great. Sure, okay. It sounds like you've got it covered, honey. I'll see you a bit later then, all right? I love you.
It's a question. Sometimes it's a question, isn't it? In the question, there's a lot of stuff. I love you too, I answer. In the answer, there's a lot of stuff. And then he's gone. Shit, I didn't ask how he was. I didn't even ask where he was. It sounded outdoorsy, busy, crowded, maybe a station, but I really don't have time for this. I race up to the top landing, fumble the loft ladder stick into its hook in the ceiling, and pull. I find them, up in the loft, exactly where I left them, tucked under a loose layer of pastel yellow insulation, in their pouch, glittering in the cream leather, gently warmed by the heating pipes. I seize them and push the insulation back into place. As I'm making my way down the ladder, the doorbell rings. I freeze, mid-ladder rung, a flash of terror like a shot through my system. I suddenly wish we still had that gun, the one we dumped in the sea in Bora Bora. Were we stupid not to keep it? Do I need it? But then, what the hell would I do with a gun? I don't know how to use one. I wouldn't even know if it was loaded or how to do the safety catch or anything. No, I don't need a gun. This will be fine. I'm being paranoid. It's broad daylight. I continue down the ladder from the loft, jumping the last three rungs and sprinting back down to the hall. Hot-cheeked, I pull open the front door, grateful for the blast of September wind it lets in. And there stands Simon. Simon looks harmless. Suit, tie, smile. Not the smile of a predator, just the smile of an iffy friend of your dad's, maybe. A little bit too knowing a smile, but ultimately harmless. I don't need a gun. Of that, I'm suddenly sure. His manner suggests we're both in this together. I'm part of the gang now. Simon? I have to say something. We've been standing in silence for slightly too long now.
Guilty as charged? He grins.
I'm pretty sure he's used that one before, but the inoffensive humor settles me. Great. I nod. I really don't know what we do next. Do you want to come in? I hazard. From my tone, I think it's fairly clear to Simon that I have no idea how this situation is usually supposed to go. I'm hoping he'll take the lead quite soon.
Nah, got a dash. Thanks though, love. I'll just grab the stuff and get out of your air, if that's all right.
He's dealing with me beautifully. I appreciate this delicate handling of my obvious ineptitude. In an odd way, it's very reassuring. I hand him the pouch. I'm relieved to be unburdened. That's half the battle. He takes it. But what about the money? Should I say something? Is that rude? But he beats me to it.
You got a number for me?
He's one step ahead. He's obviously done this before. Yes, yes, here we go. I fish the paper slip out of my pocket and smooth it out on my upper thigh. Sorry, it's creased. You can still see the numbers though, can't you? I pass it to him. We both stare down at the slip of paper in his hand. Very clearly legible through the slight folds. I'm an absolute moron.
Yep, that should be fine,
he mumbles, over-feigning interest in the crumpled slip.
Right, I should be off then.
He weighs both hands, a note in one, a million-pound pouch in the other. He grins and turns to leave, then stops.
One quick question, love. How'd it go today? Eddie wants to know.
I don't think it's going to work out. I say it gently, as if I'm personally heartbroken about the cruel twist of fate. Eddie, the reformed hero, denied a second chance with his daughter. Simon seems confused by my answer.
Why? What did she do?
He looks at me quizzically. Well, she watched it, the video. She cried. She was extremely upset, but she was concerned about her children and...
Oh, the kids.
He interrupts.
Oh, well, fair enough.
He seems satisfied. I wonder if this was an official inquiry about Lottie or if I've spoken out of turn.
Don't worry about the kids.
Simon's smiling again. Order restored.
He can get around all that. Good work though, sweetheart. She cried, eh? Nice. Very good sign. Eddie's going to bloody love that. That'll cheer him right up. If she's crying, we're halfway there.
He beams at me. Today's going well for him.
Right, darling. I'm off then. Take care.
And with a cheery hand raise, he's away.
Thank you, Simon.
I call after him. I don't know why. I have to say something, don't I? I can't just stand there in silence as he strides back towards his black Mercedes with my diamonds in the palm of his hand. Chapter 33. Thursday, September the 29th. Loose ends. An extremely large bunch of flowers arrives in the morning.
Thanks for your help. Shan't forget it. E.
He's got style. I'll give him that. But Mark is less sure. It's not exactly covert, is it? He asks over breakfast. He's worried about police surveillance. They're only flowers, Mark. They could be for doing the interview, for all anyone knows, through a lawyer or something. I'm pretty sure Eddie knows how to cover his tracks at this point in his career. Well, except for the bookkeeping, obviously. I smile. We've done it, after all, haven't we? The full payment for the diamonds hit the numbered account at midnight last night. Much more than we expected. Certainly a lot more than I thought we'd ever be able to get by ourselves. 2 million. Two. Sterling. I literally cannot keep the smile off my face. 10 grand a pop per stone. Eddie barely took a cut. The payment came from another numbered account. Wherever Eddie's money is squirreled away, I guess. Great minds think alike. Mark's worried. I'm sure the gift trail will be covered from his end, Aaron. It's our end I'm worried about. If SO15 are watching you, they'll wonder. He gestures to the massive bouquet. It's not exactly low-key, is it? He has a point, I suppose. The flowers look ridiculously ostentatious. But can the police really be monitoring me 24 hours a day, Mark? Seriously? Why would they? And how would Eddie not know that? Yes, potentially, yes, they could be, Erin. If they think Holly might contact you, if they notice anything strange, they might be watching you in case she tries to call you or, God forbid, shows up on our doorstep. But why on earth would she do that, Mark? We weren't exactly close, were we? We met once. I interviewed her for 30 minutes once. I don't think the police think that will happen, and I don't think we're being watched by them. At least, not to the extent you think. Maybe they're monitoring our home phone, but I really feel like that's something Eddie might have looked into before helping us. Something he might have mentioned. He's not an idiot. If SO15 is watching us, I think we'd be aware of it by now. If anything, I feel like Eddie's presence is protecting us from a lot of things right now. Mark looks distractedly out the window, watching the rain, his thoughts whirring away silently. Why isn't Mark happy? I tentatively touch his arm across the table. It's done. We have all the bag money. It's safe. With the paper money and the diamonds combined, we have just under £3 million. Untraceable. Completely secure. We did it, Mark. We actually did it. I look at him expectant. A smile breaks across his face. A small one. I squeeze his arm. His smile widens to a grin. He nods, reaching for his mug of tea.
I'm pleased it worked out. I am, obviously.
But Aaron, you can't do any more stuff like this. You just can't. It's worked out this time, but no more, right? No more risks. We're done now. He is happy, of course. But I worry him. And I can't blame him for not trusting me, really. I've been keeping secrets. And there were definitely a couple of moments there when I thought he might be right. That I might have gone too far. But now the money's in the bank. Yes, yes, I'm done now, I promise. There's nothing more to take risks for. I lean across the table and plant a kiss on his warm lips. I can tell he's not entirely convinced. but he smiles and kisses me back. He wants things the way they were. Hopefully, we can go back to that now. Finally. But no sooner does that thought settle in than I remember. Those loose ends, up in the attic, a trail of evidence leading all the way back to the bottom of the South Pacific. It isn't quite over yet. But what should we do with the phone, Mark? The USB? Should we dump them? They're the only link back to us. We need to finish things properly, don't we? We don't want loose ends. He squeezes his eyes shut as the realization sinks in. We're not quite finished. He'd forgotten them. Damn. Okay, let's think. He takes a moment, gazes through the rain-speckled window out into the wet garden. Maybe we should keep the phone, just in case. There's no harm in keeping it, and if anything ever happens, we'll have it as evidence of who these people are, or leverage against them. Not that I'm saying we'll need it, but maybe for insurance. He pauses, then shakes his head. You know what? No. We'll dump it too. Dump it all. The USB and the phone. We need them out of the house. In case, for any reason, the police want to search the house. We need it all out of our lives. His tone is firm. There will be no further discussion on this. And that's okay with me. I'm done now. All done. 3 million done. Perhaps we can drive up to Norfolk together. Right now. Stay the night. Take a boat out in the morning and drop them into the sea. Make a day of it. The last loose ends, I suggest. His expression doesn't change. I feel a tug of fear. I continue. We need to dump them somewhere, right? We could stay up there a few days. It would be nice to get away. Just be together for a while. We need it. I miss you. I miss us. He gets up and walks around the table and cups my face in his hands. He kisses me on the lips ever so gently. I love that idea. It feels like a long time ago, just you and me, the honeymoon. I know what he means, our real honeymoon, before the bag came along, before it turned into something else. All I want right now is just to be near him. I miss my skin on his skin. I miss the closeness. If we go up to Norfolk today, then that's it. The phone and the flash drive are the last things, and it's done after we've got rid of them. Finished. I promise. We can go back to the way we were, but better, because this time we'll never have to worry about money again. Mark will never have to worry about losing everything ever again. He'll never have to worry about having to work in a bar or stack shelves ever again. Up in Norfolk, I can finally tell him about our baby. He looks down at me, studying my face. There's a ghost of sadness in his eyes. I suppose he's not convinced I truly decided to stop being so reckless. Perhaps we can't get back to where we were. I need to prove to him that I am focused on us now. So I press him. We need the time together, Mark. Please. His eyes fill almost imperceptibly, and suddenly I realize how much I've pushed him away over the past few weeks. I have very nearly broken this thing we have. This bond needs to be handled with care, nursed back to health. He stoops down again and kisses my forehead. I know. And as much as I love the idea, honey, I can't go away today. You know that. Remember? Oh, God. I totally forgot. He told me this last week. He mentioned it. I feel awful. As if I didn't feel awful enough already. He's flying to New York this afternoon. An overnight stay. I wasn't listening properly when he said it, obviously. I wonder what else I've totally missed. I am the worst wife. He's meeting new clients in New York City all day tomorrow, and then traveling straight back that evening on the overnight flight. A literal flying visit. I'll be here alone. I can't help all of a sudden feeling frightened, that Mark's moving forward with his life without me. It's my fault, of course. I should have shown more interest in his new business instead of spending all my time thinking about the documentary, the money, the diamonds. I should have been present more. I should have been with him. Self-recrimination washes over me. I will have to do better. I will have to be better. It will all be fine. We can go away the following weekend together. It's not a big deal. It just feels like one now. I lie on the bed while he packs, watching. He tells me all about the new office spaces he's considering, his big plans.
Will you come and see them with me next week? He asks.
He's so excited. Of course, I can't wait. I assure him. I'm glad he's letting me back in. I'm glad he's this happy again. Maybe the rift is finally starting to close up. I'm sorry, Mark, if I've been absent, if I haven't been here for you. I'm sorry. I look up at him. It's all okay, Erin. His face is alive with the future and everything that's laid out ahead.
You've had a lot on your plate. It's fine. I love you.
He holds my gaze and I feel forgiven. I'm a very lucky person. I think again about telling him everything, about the pregnancy, but I don't want to tip the balance. I'll tell him once he's back, when we're alone together next weekend. I love you, Mark, I tell him instead, scrambling off the bed and wrapping myself around him. And I mean it, with all that I am. My hormones must be doing something crazy inside me right now, because it physically hurts later as his airport taxi pulls away from the curb outside our house. My whole body keens for him, the ghost of his arms around me, the scent of his cologne still clinging to my skin. After he's gone, I make my way up to the loft to inspect the last remaining evidence. It's hot in the attic. Under the insulation, the phone is toasty warm. The separate envelope containing the USB drive lies next to it. Is the heat of the loft bad for the memory of the phone or drive? I finger the USB through the plastic of the envelope. It's warm to the touch. I stare at the phone's inert screen and remember the text message from 2 weeks ago, the way it made me feel in my stomach. Those three grey dots, pulsing. Who is this? Again, I wonder who they are. The dead people on the plane, the person on the other end of the phone, the plane people. I've tried to ignore this question, to listen to Mark's advice, but here on my own, in the hot, dusty loft, the thought grows stronger. Who are they? I've searched Russian websites, news sites, nothing. Is Patrick one of them? Or is Mark right? Could he be an undercover SO-15 officer? Is it him who's calling me and leaving silent messages? The sickening thought flashed through my mind the other day that the calls might be from Holly. Silent, desperate phone messages from somewhere out there. Maybe she's back in England. But then I remember the low, mumbled reply to the waiter in the message. And besides, Holly's never even had my phone number, so it can't be her. My mind gravitates back to the plain people. Could it be them? Mark was certain it wasn't. But maybe they found the hotel's IP address. Maybe they went there. Maybe they killed the Sharps. But would they have stopped looking after that? For how long would they have kept looking? What were the bag and its contents worth to them? And then it hits me with stunning clarity. They're still looking. And I'm alone now. I think of Mark's face as he drove away in the taxi. They might still be out there, searching for us. Maybe they've realized they killed the wrong couple, and now here I am alone in the house. I've been so concerned with keeping ahead of the police, of converting what we found into real money, that I've completely forgotten about the reality of being found by the people we stole from. The reality of a knock at the door, a shot to the head. I think of the open back door 6 days ago. It's just me here now, alone, and I don't want to die. I need to find out what I'm dealing with. I need to find out who might be coming for me. And with that, I take their phone downstairs, slip on my coat, and leave the house. It's time to turn it on again. Somewhere safe. Somewhere busy. When I get to Leicester Square, I weave through and around the crowds and head for the garden at its center. I find a group of foreign exchange students talking on and playing with their phones whilst they eat their lunches on the grass. I stand as close as acceptable, and only then do I turn the phone on. It struggles back to life, slowly. The screen flashes white. The Apple symbol. Then the home screen. I don't even attempt to put it on airplane mode. I let it find signal. And it does. The signal bars fill to 5. You see, my thinking is, Leicester Square is the busiest pedestrian thoroughfare in Europe. I googled it on my own phone before I turned it off outside our underground station. More people move through Leicester Square in a day than anywhere else in Europe. On average, 250,000 a day. As I enter the garden area, it's full of people on their phones, weaving past one another deep in conversation, or heads down, tapping away and surfing. There are 109 CCTV cameras in Leicester Square, but I challenge anyone to guess which person is on which phone. There are fuckloads of us. I'm hiding in plain sight. Let them find the signal. It won't help them. The screen flares to life. Text messages ping up on the phone. 2 messages. The offer still stands. Contact me. From the same number as before. The number that knows someone has the bag. But I don't understand what the message means. What offer? I scroll up for more, but I see only the old messages I read in Bora Bora. Then I notice a small red circle over the call icon. I check the missed call log. There have been 2 missed calls from the same number since we've been in possession of the bag. Since I sent that ridiculous text message in Bora Bora. 2 missed calls. And 1 voicemail. I sit down on a bench, hit the voicemail icon, and lift the phone to my ear. The first voice I hear is the voice of the network carrier's automated system. It's female, but in a language I don't understand. Eastern European? Russian? Then silence, followed by a long beep. It connects. I hear the closed-in silence of a room. Someone waiting close to the receiver to speak. Then the voice comes, thick and calm. It's male. The language is English, but with an accent that's hard to distinguish.
You received the previous message. The offer stands. Contact us.
The message ends. I have no idea what it's referring to. What previous message? What offer? The system voice prattles on in Russian, and then the man's voice returns. A saved message. The previous message.
You have something that belongs to us. We would like it returned.
I feel my breath catch in my throat.
I'm not sure how you came into contact with it. It's not important at this stage, but it will be in your interest to return it to us.
It suddenly occurs to me that someone has already listened to this voicemail. That's why it didn't show up as new. Someone has heard it. I think of our back door standing ajar. I think of Patrick's cold hand in my warm one. I think of SO15. I think of Simon and Eddie. Has someone been in our attic? Who? But then I realize there's only really one person who could have listened to this. Because why would the man on the phone right now, if he really was searching for us, break into our house and listen to his own message? And if it was DCI Foster and SO15, why would they not have immediately seized everything they found as evidence? And if it had been someone to do with Eddie who heard this, then why would Eddie still have paid us £2 million if he could have taken everything? The truth is that no one else has been in our attic. Which must mean that I'm not the only one who's been keeping secrets. Mark has already listened to this voicemail.
We will reimburse you a finder's fee for your troubles.
I glance around the square, heart pounding through my chest. It's crazy, I know, but all at once I am certain that someone is watching me again. I scan the faces in the crowd, but no one seems interested in me. No one is looking. I suddenly feel utterly alone. Alone in a sea of strangers. I snap back to the voice.
If you have the flash drive, contact me on this number. The offer is 2 million euros.
Euros? That means he's in Europe, right? Or he knows we are. Does he know we're in the UK? He'll have traced this phone's signal whenever Mark last accessed it. He'll know we're in London by now.
The amount is non-negotiable. If you can supply this, we will make the exchange. We're not interested in pursuing you. We require only the USB. Whether you choose to assist us in retrieving it or not, however, is up to you. Contact me.
The message ends. The flash drive? I had completely forgotten about the USB. No mention of the bag money, no mention of the diamonds. They just want the USB. More than the diamonds, more than the money. What the fuck is on the USB? I can't catch my breath. Do I even want to know? Holy shit. I turn off the phone, just in case. You never know. Why didn't Mark tell me about this? Why did he turn on the phone in the first place? And where did he turn it on? Of course, he's far more cautious than I am. He'd have gone to a crowded area too. He's a clever guy. But why? Why look? And then I realize. He too was worried about them coming for us. Of course he was worried. After the Sharps accident, he felt responsible, in a way, for what happened to them. He knew it was deliberate, and it scared him. So he pretended, for me. Mark's very convincing when he wants to be. So he checked the phone. He checked to see if they were still looking for us. And they were. And he kept it to himself, to protect me, to keep me from being terrified. The guilt makes my chest ache. I can't believe Mark's been going through all this alone, and with me running around so recklessly. But then I realize that's probably why he didn't tell me, isn't it? He wanted to stop me finding out about this offer. He knew I'd want to do it, to make the exchange. And now that I think about it, yes, yes, I do want to do it. Because if we can play it right, if we can just play this last situation right, we'll win it all. We can't stop now anyway. It's not safe to stop. If we don't give them back what they want, they'll never stop looking for us. And I know Mark didn't tell me about the voicemail because it's clearly a stupid idea. And I know it's stupid because they don't really know where we are, or they'd have just taken the USB already. And it's stupid because we don't need any more money. And I'm stupid because I have been driving this whole thing from the very beginning, and now that I've heard this voice message, all I want in the whole world is to make that deal. They might not know where we are now, but they will keep looking, and I want them to stop. And I want that extra 2 million euros. Mark knows me so well, better than I know myself. And that is why he didn't tell me. Because he knows I will definitely do something reckless. What did they say in the message?
We are not interested in pursuing you. We require only the USB. Whether you choose to assist us in retrieving it or not, however, is up to you.
Is that a threat? Not exactly. A warning. They don't want us. They just want their memory stick. But if we make that hard for them, then maybe it becomes a threat. Wait, wait, wait. 2 million euros. What the actual fuck is on that USB? And that is the question that propels me as I sprint out of Leicester Square and towards our attic back in North London. Chapter 34. Thursday, September the 29th. A damsel in distress. I lift the installation, pull out the warm envelope and open it. There is no USB. It's not there. The stubby object I felt through the plastic earlier is just a long, empty casing. The USB itself is gone from inside it. Gone. I stare, bewildered. What does it mean? I stand in the attic, winded by the run from the tube station, sweat rolling down my skin, gasping for breath. Where has it gone? Have they already come for it? No, they can't have. They'd have taken the phone, too. They'd have done something to us. I remind myself that no one else has been in the house but Mark and me. It must be Mark. What has he done? Has he thrown it out? Has he hidden it elsewhere, in case I listened to the message and tried to find it? What has he done with it? I turn on my own phone and check the time. He'll be on his flight now. I can't reach him. I feel another wave of nausea and slump down on one of the attic beams. I should take it easy. Less running. I look down at the screen of my phone again. I'll text him. I heard the voicemails. Why didn't you tell me? Where is it? I stare down at the message. Thumb poised over send. No, this isn't right. Too furious, too panicked. He must have a pretty serious reason why he hasn't told me, and I haven't told him a lot of things too. I delete the message and type instead. Mark, call me when you land. I love you. Kiss, kiss, kiss. I press send. That's better. He can explain later. He'll have hidden the USB in case I try and do something stupid. I think about where it could be. I wonder if he knows what's on it. I want to know what's on it. It'll be in the house somewhere. It has to be. I start in the bedroom. I try all his usual hiding places. We've lived together for 4 years now, and I'm pretty sure I know them all. I check his bedside drawer, the small combination box inside it. The code is his birthday, but there's nothing inside apart from some foreign currency. I peer under his side of the mattress. He once hid some Patti Smith concert tickets there for my birthday. Nothing. I fish through the pockets of his grandfather's overcoat in the wardrobe, old shoe boxes in the top cupboard. Then I move to the bathroom, an aftershave box at the back of the bathroom cabinet, his desk, his old briefcase, nothing, nothing, nothing. He's hidden it well. Or maybe he's taken it with him. Maybe he doesn't trust me at all. But I know he wouldn't have taken the USB with him. If there's a chance he might lose it, he wouldn't take it. If he's hidden it from me, it'll be here, somewhere in this house. And that's when I get angry. I turn the house upside down. I search every inch. I pull out everything. I empty full bags of rice. I strip beds. I check the linings of curtains and bags. Nothing. I stand sweating and disheveled in a house torn apart. I'm dizzy and nauseous. This is not me taking it easy. I need to raise my blood sugar right now. If not for me, then for what's trying to grow inside me. I plonk down where I am in the middle of the living room and drag a Liberty of London bag full of wedding gifts towards me. I fish down to the bottom and grab a tin of truffles. Rose champagne truffles. They'll do. I prise off the lid and dig in. And then I find it. Just like that. Nestled on the bottom deck of the truffle box. Fuck, Mark. What are you playing at? Exhausted, I eat my truffles in triumphant silence. The USB is company, the daylight fading around me. At some point in the darkness, my phone starts to bleat. I fumble it out from under the detritus of my search. It's Mark. He must have landed. Hello?
Hi, honey. Is everything okay?
He sounds worried. Could he know I found it? Mark, why did you hide it? There's no point beating around the bush. I'm drained. I'm hurt.
Hide what? What are you talking about?
He sounds amused. I can hear the bustle in the background behind him. He's on the other side of the world. Mark, I found the USB. Why did you lie? Why did you hide it? Why didn't you tell me about the messages? I can feel my eyes welling, but I will not cry.
Ah, right. I was wondering when this might come up. You found it? Have you looked at what's on it?
Yes, no, I only just found it. I stare at it in the half-light, sitting innocently in the palm of my hand. a mystery.
I'm sorry, Erin, honey, but I know you too well. I listened to the message. I had to after what happened to the Sharps. In the voicemail, he said he wanted just the flash drive, nothing else. I needed to see what was on it, why it meant so much to him. So I looked, and Erin, what I saw really worried me. All of it scared me. I just wanted to protect you. But I knew that sooner or later you'd look too, and if you heard that voicemail, you wouldn't be able to not look at the USB, so I hid it.
He gives me a second to process what he said.
But obviously not well enough.
He jokes and laughs. He's struggling to lighten the mood.
Erin, I'm sorry, but will you promise me you won't look on it, honey? Please, just leave it alone until I get back. Can you promise me that?
I've never heard his voice sound so serious, so worried.
Promise me. Just put it back where you found it, honey. And once I'm back, we'll burn it together. Don't do anything. We'll put the phone and the USB in the fire pit, and we'll watch them burn. Okay?
He says soothingly. God, he really does know me so well. All right, I whisper. I feel sad, and I'm not sure why. Maybe because I can't be trusted. I love you, Mark.
Great. Listen, Erin, I'm sorry. I didn't know what else to do. Maybe I should have told you.
No, he was right. I would have done all those things. No, you did the right thing, and I love you. I say again.
I love you too, honey. Call me if you need anything.
I love you. And then he's gone. I'm broken, confused, and incredibly thirsty. I pour myself a tall glass of ice water from the fridge door. I stare at our beautiful kitchen, the handmade work surfaces, the integrated wine refrigerator, the slate tile floor radiating underfloor heating up through my socks. I look at our kitchen decimated by my crazed search. Pots and pans, packets of food and cleaning products scattered everywhere. And there, among it all, is my laptop. I don't stop to think. I stumble across to it and I flip the lid on the computer, pull the USB out of its wrapping and slide it into the port. A new device icon flashes up on my desktop. I double-click. A window opens. Files. I click on the first. It opens. Text. Encrypted. Pages and pages of encrypted text. Files on files of encrypted text. Nonsense stares back at me. I don't know what it says. I don't even know what it is. I don't understand it. I can't make it work, and it terrifies me. Perhaps Mark knows what it means. Perhaps it's a banking thing, a numbers thing. But why then warn me away? I don't know what I'm looking at. But my breath is shallow now because even I can tell that this is important. Even I can see that. We shouldn't have this USB. It's not for people like us. And I can't tell Mark I looked. Now I know, with crystal clarity, that I am completely out of my depth. Who are they? And what is this? Is this what they killed the Sharps for? Why is it so important to them? Why aren't they concerned about the money or the diamonds? Why is this worth 2 million euros? Are we going to die for this? I need to think. I eject the drive and place it carefully back into its plastic. Breathe, Erin. Think. Okay, what should I do? First of all, I really need to know what is on this USB. If I can find out, I'll know the kind of people I'm dealing with. I remember the emails I saw in Bora Bora, the shell companies, the papers floating in the water. Who are these people? What are they capable of? How much danger are we in? If somehow I can get these files unencrypted, I'll know. If there's something awful, maybe I should go to the police. Maybe I should go now. But I want to know. I need to know what this is. I haven't the faintest idea how to decrypt files, but I think I might know someone who does. I stuff the USB into my pocket, grab my coat. Eddie's mobile number is scrawled on the back of the card that came with his bouquet this morning. I, Erin Roberts, have direct access to Eddie Bishop's illegal prison burner phone. And what's the point of having contacts if you're not going to use them? I pluck the card from the flowers as I pass them in the hall and dash out of the house. There's a smashed-up phone box on Lordship Road. I've driven by it enough times to wonder, A, why no one ever sweeps up or repairs the broken glass, and B, who on earth uses the terrifying-looking thing? Well, I realize as I stride purposely down the long stretch of suburban road towards it, today, that lucky someone is me. I honestly can't remember the last time I used a payphone. Maybe school? Calling home with my 10 pence pieces lined up along the shelf in the booth? When I reach the phone box, it's worse than I remembered. The booth is a hollow plastic cage, carpeted with milky shards of glass, and clumps of weeds have burst through the cracked tarmac. There are spiders suspended from the empty window panes, slow and befuddled in the wet air. At least the open air diffuses the stale stench of piss. I rattle my coat for change. A fat 2-pound coin hits my palm. Perfect. I dial Eddie's number. When he answers, he's chewing something. I look at my watch. 1:18, lunchtime. Oops. Hi, Eddie. Sorry to bother you. It's Erin. I got this number from the flowers. I'm on a payphone, so... I think that means we can talk safely, but what do I know? He'll be the judge of that.
Oh, right. Hello, darling. You all right, sweetheart? Problems?
He stops chewing. Somewhere in Pentonville, I hear Eddie wipe his mouth with a paper napkin. Do the guards know about Eddie's burner phone? I wouldn't be surprised if they did, and they just looked the other way. No problems, really. But I've got a question. I don't know if you'd know, or if you know someone else who might know, but... I stop. Can I talk on this? I don't want to incriminate myself. I don't want to make things worse.
Yeah, should be fine, sweetheart. Anyone near you? Watching you? Street cameras?
I scan the tops of lampposts along the residential street, my breath catching in my throat. I chose this road because it's the emptiest road near us. Hardly any passers-by. But now I start to wonder, do all London streets have CCTV in some form? But the angled cameras or small circular pods I'm searching for are nowhere to be seen here. I think we're safe. No people, no cameras, I say into the receiver.
Then it's fine.
I hear a smile in his voice. I've caught his interest. I'm sorry to bother you again. It's just I've got a slight, well, a situation. Do you know anything about file encryption, Eddie? Do you know anyone I could talk to about it? It's important. I need to mask the urgency in my voice. I don't want to scare him off. I don't want to seem overly familiar either. At the end of the day, I'm asking for another favor, and this time I really have nothing to give in exchange for it.
Computer stuff, right? Yeah, we got a guy. Here, look. Tell me the gist, and I'll give my guy a ring, and we'll go from there. You like those flowers, by the way, sweetheart? I asked him for something nice and tasteful, but you never know with those sort of places, do you?
Eddie's a very sweet man. I think of my monstrous bouquet back in the hall. Under different circumstances, I think Eddie and I would have really gotten along. Sorry, Eddie, yes, yes, I did. They're gorgeous. Very tasteful. Thank you so much. I'm just glad I could help out.
You did, sweetheart. You did. My daughter means the world to me. Now, what's the problem then?
Okay, so I've got an encrypted USB. In a nutshell, I'm not really sure what I'm dealing with here. I need to know what's on that stick. I lay it out for him, a problem shared. Eddie clears his throat.
Where did you get it?
His tone has turned serious. I can't say. I'm not sure who exactly I'm dealing with. I need to know what's on the USB in order to know what I need to do now.
Listen, Erin, I'm going to stop you there, sweetheart. You don't need to know anything. So do everyone a favor and drop that idea. If that thing belongs to someone else, and they've gone to all the trouble of encrypting it, you don't need to know what's on it. Because it's bad. It's bad stuff they don't want people reading.
Did Mark read it, I wonder? I think of the pages and pages of scrambled text. Could Mark have figured out what they meant? Does he already know too much? Eddie continues.
My gut says you copy what you got. I'm guessing you'll be handing the original on. Exchanging?
Yes. Yes, I will. I hadn't thought that far. For a second, I feel so much relief I'm dizzy. Calling Eddie was the right thing to do. He knows how to deal with these people.
Right, well, you exchange one-on-one. You take backup in case they don't want to play nice. You do exactly what they say. And don't hand anything over until you got the money. You made that mistake the other day with Simon. I heard all about it. It's very endearing, sweetheart, but it's not the way things get done. You exchange after the money's gone into your account, not before. You understand?
The question hangs on the line between us. Yes, yes. Thank you, Eddie, I say. It feels weird being this honest with a criminal. I can tell him more than I'd ever tell Mark. I know he's right. I should just take the offer, make sure I cover all my bases, and go for it. It's what Eddie would do.
Do you need anyone to help you with the handover? I could get Simon around to help out.
He says, his voice soft now. I feel like this is personal. Eddie's worried about me. I think I've got it covered, Eddie. But can I let you know? I'm aware I sound fragile. A damsel in distress. I'd like to say it's a deliberate, manipulative move to garner assistance, but it's not. As I've said, I'm just way out of my depth. But I can't let Simon and Eddie help me. I can't take on more than one front at a time. I don't know if I can trust Eddie and his gang with this. He's a criminal at the end of the day. I understand the irony of that statement, but you know what I mean. I need to figure this out myself first. Alone.
Okay, sweetheart. Well, you know where I am if you need me.
Oh, Eddie, do you know where I could get, protection? That's probably the least persuasive request for a firearm ever uttered. But I think I might definitely need it now. He's silent for a second.
You know how to use one?
He asks businesslike. Yes, I lie. Yes, I do.
Well, well. I said you were full of surprises. Not a problem, sweetheart. Simon will drop what you need around tonight. Look after yourself, sweetheart. Stay safe. You need to talk again. Next time you call using a different phone box. Different area. No more Lordship Road. Mix it up.
How does he know where I'm calling from? For an instant, I feel sick. I will. Thanks, Eddie. Really appreciate it.
All right, love. Ta-ta.
The line goes dead. I'm going to end this situation. I'm going to end it for both of us, Mark and me. We can't hide from what's coming. Mark doesn't know what he's doing. We can't just squirrel the USB away in chocolate boxes and hope for the best. We need to finish what we've started, and properly, because now I'm absolutely certain that they won't stop until they have the USB. We've turned the phone on 2 times now. They must know we're in London. Now it's just a question of when and where we meet. And on whose terms. I think of the Sharps. Of their fate. Those last desperate gasping breaths of seawater and then... nothing. But the difference between the Sharps and me is that the Sharps weren't expecting what happened to them. They weren't prepared. They panicked. They didn't stand a chance. But I do. I head to St. Pancras Station, and in the crowd below the giant clock I turn on the phone. Passengers spill from the Eurostar through the glass in front of me. I tap on messages, tap on the text box of a most recent message and write, I have flash drive. Happy to exchange. Meeting instructions to follow. I tap send, turn off the phone, and I slip it into my coat pocket. Now I just need somewhere to meet. At home, I spend the night trawling YouTube videos to prepare. If there's one thing I'm good at, it's doing my research, and it never ceases to amaze me what you can learn off the internet. I watch videos on handgun assembly, specifically Glock 22 assembly and disassembly. Simon dropped off a Glock 22 with two boxes of bullets 2 hours ago. I made him a cup of tea, and he left with the cup. I've been watching the videos ever since. Glock cleaning, how to handle a handgun, Glock safety features, how to shoot a handgun, how to make your handgun safe pre and post usage. And 2 hours in, I'm happy to say it's about as hard to take apart a handgun and reassemble it as it is to change a Brita water filter, if you're interested. Apparently WD-40 is an acceptable substitution for gun oil, as long as you intend to relube and clean after a 3 to 4 day period. My gun only needs to work for 1 day, and I'm hoping it doesn't actually need to work at all. I can't risk going into Holland & Holland in Piccadilly tomorrow morning and buying gun oil, just in case. Just in case SO15 is watching, or Patrick, or someone else entirely. I miss another call from Phil. He's already rung twice today to argue with me about why I'm dropping the Holly stuff. He's been fuming since I told him, and I've got the voicemails to prove it. I still haven't called him back. He can wait. Everyone can wait. Glock 22s are absurdly easy to use. Not many buttons. Not much you can fuck up. The thing about a Glock is it doesn't have a safety catch. You know that bit in films when the heroine finally needs to use her gun, and she raises it to the looming bad guy, squeezes the trigger and... click. Nothing. The safety's on. Well, that won't happen with a Glock. With a Glock, his head explodes. If the magazine is in, and it's cocked, that's it. Point and shoot. And it will only fire if a finger pulls the trigger. You can drop it, or snag the trigger, or shove it in your waistband, whatever, it won't go off. The double trigger system means your finger has to go into the trigger bed and pull all the way back. That's the only way a Glock fires. But if you grab the gun out of that waistband and accidentally touch that trigger bed on the way, you'll most certainly never have kids. No safety means no safety. My mobile bursts to life again. This time it's Nancy, Fred's wife. God damn it. I forgot to thank her for watching the house for us while we were on honeymoon, and for the food she left us. I haven't got back to Fred either about the footage. They're probably worried. Mark is right. I am forgetful. I let it go to voicemail. If you ever find a Glock, you'll know it's a Glock because of the logo on the bottom right of the hand grip. A big G, little lock written inside it. If you find one, then here's what you do. First, keeping your hand away from the trigger, pick up the gun. There should be a small button right by your thumb on the grip. That's the magazine release. Place your other hand under the butt and push the thumb button. The magazine will pop out of the butt and into your hand. If the magazine is full, you'll see a bullet at the top of the magazine. Now, pop the magazine down somewhere safe. Next, you need to check/empty the chamber. In other words, see if there's a bullet in there, and if there is, eject it. You do this by pulling the top section of the barrel backwards away from the tip of the gun. The little window should open on the top of the gun as you cock back. If there's a bullet, it should pop safely up and out of the top as you cock. Cock back again to double-check the chamber is clear. Now your gun is safe. Then, to load it, pop that bullet into the top of the magazine you set aside. Slide the whole magazine back into the butt of the gun until it clicks. Cock it again, point, and shoot. Practice that routine about 20 times and you'll be as convincing as any actor in Full Metal Jacket. Besides, It keeps your thoughts from buzzing around the reasons you might need the gun in the first place. Mark calls before bed to check on me. It's the one call I do take. Yeah, I'm fine, just watching stuff on the computer.